100 years ago. Ask the Hospitallers where the money is. I don't have it.
Domenico hadn't believed the Templars' protestations of innocence in the 14th century, and he didn't believe Matthew now. Neither had the witches, nor their present-day descendants within the Hospitallers. And now the de Clermonts had a witch in their possession. It was a dangerous game Matthew was playing.
The witches are always looking for an excuse to go to war with your family, Matthew. They have been since Jerusalem. And now you've given it to them with this madness over Diana Bishop. Just make her one of us, and she will be ours to protect. The witches won't be able to use your romantic indiscretion as a premise for war, and every vampire will support you. She is already mine to protect, Matthew said coldly. I don't need to make her a vampire, and I don't need your support.
Domenico bristled.
You are the only creature in the world who thinks she belongs to you, and not even Diana Bishop believes it. And as long as neither you nor the witch herself sees her as de Clermont, every moment you spend with her puts her in greater danger.
Matthew's eyes flickered. Domenico noted it with satisfaction.
Ah, he thought. That's the way to win this battle. Emphasize that the witch is in danger. From Matthew himself.
He decided to tip his hand.
You cannot keep her with you, kiss her and sing songs to her in the night, without courting war and utter destruction, Domenico continued. You know this, brother. I'm not the only vampire on the congregation. Gébert has a seat alongside me, and you've seen him protect our kind ruthlessly from threats far smaller than the one posed by your dalliance with this witch. Have you and Gébert been spying on me?
Matthew looked murderous.
Gébert has. I've been too busy.
Domenico sniffed.
I'll make Gébert apologize for his appalling behavior then.
Matthew kept his features still, trying not to think what his old neighbor would do to Diana if she came within his power. The prospect was more frightening than his worst fears about Domenico.
Don't worry about Gébert, Matthew. He's one of us.
Domenico smothered his exasperation. The de Clermont and Gébert were always settling old scores, most of which the Venetian didn't understand. Domenico didn't like Gébert d'Aurillac, but at least he was properly cautious around the other vampire.
It's the witches you need to worry about. The ones on the congregation are not the superstitious fools they've been in the past. These witches have real power, and they're not afraid to use it. What do the demons of the congregation think about all of this?
Matthew inquired quietly.
You've told me what you and Gébert think, and the witches. Are the demons no longer taken seriously? We've never taken them seriously. They're so unpredictable. You've always been fond of demons, but I wouldn't pin my hopes on their rallying to your side in this case. Besides, it hardly matters what they think. You couldn't win a judgment even if all three demons supported you. The vote would be 6-3. I still don't believe you issued this warning because a vampire kissed a witch.
Matthew ran his fingers through his hair in an exasperated gesture that Domenico had seen before.
You started hunting her the minute she got her hands on that manuscript, and you won't stop until she gets it back for you. And we all know what will happen then. The witches will destroy her. I will not stand by and let that happen. The only one hunting her now is you, Domenico said bluntly.
Matthew's face blazed with anger. But both vampires knew that if the de Clermont stopped concentrating on protecting Diana for an instant and let his hunger get the better of him, no one could protect her from his need to possess her. Domenico watched as the older vampire wrestled with his feelings. It was fascinating to see how strong this witch's hold was, even on a powerful and ancient vampire like de Clermont. Domenico wondered idly what it would be like to taste her, knowing that the Frenchman wanted her for himself. Louisa de Clermont had been delicious, and he had enjoyed every drop of blood the two had exchanged in their lovemaking, and in the fierce fights that both preceded and followed their nights together. Part of the charm of having Louisa, Domenico knew, was taking something that belonged in some small way to Matthew. But Matthew believed that this witch was his entirely. Not only would her blood be sweet, but every drop he consumed would destroy a part of his former friend's soul. Domenico's revenge on Matthew would at last be complete. High overhead, a canvas flag snapped in the breeze. Domenico looked up, trying to locate the sound, and saw a black flag with a writhing silver serpent flying from the keep's main tower. He swore under his breath. It was only a momentary lapse, but Matthew launched himself with a low roar across the ground that separated them. The force of his body carried his enemy into the trunk of the chestnut tree outside the gate. His fingers closed around Domenico's face and neck.
"I don't know what game you're playing, brother," Matthew said with bared teeth. "But I have never trusted you or Gilbert, and I don't mean to start now. You want Diana for some reason that goes well beyond me and her association with the de Pierremonts, and I'm going to find out what that is."
In the nearby village, a bell began to toll. Domenico had crossed swords with Matthew and with other members of the clannish de Clermont family before, and he recognized what was happening. They were closing ranks around the witch. Even Isabeau had come like an obedient puppy when Matthew had called her. Now they'd placed the whole damned town on alert.
"You've proven my point, haven't you, de Clermont?"
The Venetian fastened his own iron hands around Matthew's wrists to break his grip.
"You're a hunter, a killer. You don't think before you react. What if she makes you angry one day? Will you fly at her as quickly as you have at me?" "No one else makes me quite as angry as you, Domenico."
Matthew pressed his fingers deeper into the Venetian's neck, twisting his head to the side, and bared his teeth further.
"And that was before you had the gall to come here and ask me to keep an oath I was forced to make, simply because you behaved like a rabid wolf in Jerusalem. Kill her now, kill her later. But mark me, you will kill her in the end."
Domenico squeezed the words from his constricted throat with effort.
"Why add a civil war to the burdens already on your conscience?"
Matthew loosened his fingers and stepped away, touching the ampulla under his sweater. The Venetian resisted the urge to examine the places where the French vampire's fingers had been. His eyes returned to the black flag flying over the tallest of Septuor's crenellated towers.
"That would be my mother, warning the village that there is a vampire in the vicinity who cannot be trusted to behave like a civilized creature."
Matthew wiped the back of his hand across his mouth.
"And the lovely Diana is with her, no doubt."
Matthew ignored the barb.
"I will think about what you've said, Domenico. You can assure Gilbert that I've heard your words and will not act in haste."
Domenico made an impatient gesture. What did it matter whether Matthew thought about it or not?
"You must accept this decree, Matthew. If you don't, the witches won't be the only creatures you have to worry about."
"I don't follow orders from Gilbert, or from you. The de Clermont make their own decisions in this world. It's why we've survived so long."
"And not all of you have survived, of course," Domenico said savagely. "Your father, for instance."
"I've already warned you to be more careful, Domenico. Stop speaking of my family, and that includes Diana Bishop, the living and the dead."
"What does Baldwin think of your new infatuation?"
Domenico asked, ignoring Matthew's challenge. He knew that Philippe de Clermont's middle son had a particular loathing for witches.
"You'll have to ask him," Matthew said through clenched teeth.
"Baldwin doesn't yet know. I suspected as much."
Domenico shook his finger at Matthew.
"You and your secrets, they always catch up with you in the end, and I would love to be here when they do. Who do you think your brother will kill first, you or the witch?"
"Baldwin wouldn't kill anyone in cold blood."
"Not even a witch?"
"I'm not as sanguine about that as you seem to be."
Domenico drew a small black phone out of his pocket.
"Shall I call him? I have his number."
"If you like,"
Matthew said calmly.
"He's head of the de Clermont family now, and I don't imagine he'll be happy to hear that his youngest brother is on the verge of declaring war on every creature on the planet. I think Baldwin deserves to know. Don't you?"
"Do what you want, Domenico. You always have."
Matthew was itching to get away from the Venetian and his scent.
Brave words, Matthew, but the Baldwin will put you in your place soon enough. You can't strut around here like the king of the castle for a few more days, perhaps, but we both know who's really in charge of your family.
Matthew made another impatient sound.
I don't answer to Baldwin either. It's not the 12th century anymore, Domenico. People don't behave now as they did then. Vampires do,
Domenico said softly.
And you know it. There's nowhere on earth you and Diana Bishop will be safe, and Baldwin will be first in line to hunt you down. This interview is over. Go,
Matthew said evenly. Domenico swept a courtly bow that was both mocking and threatening. When he stood again, he kissed his fingers in the direction of the chateau.
Tell your witch I'll be seeing her soon.
Matthew watched Domenico leave and waited until he could no longer smell the Venetian's heavy odor of musk and myrrh. When his nose was clear, he looked up at the tower with sharp eyes. Isabeau and Diana were standing near the wall, locked in conversation. Lord knew what they could be talking about with such intensity. The breeze was blowing in the wrong direction, and he couldn't hear them. The sight of Diana made Matthew's heart give a sudden, painful beat. What was he going to say to her? He couldn't tell her about the choices before them. Turning her into a vampire was unthinkable, even if it was the simplest option. Diana would no doubt push up her sleeves, roll down her collar, and offer herself to the nearest vampire in an instant, if she thought it would end the creature's pursuit of her in the book. But Matthew found the idea of leaving her even more unimaginable. She was all he could think about, and when she was out of his sight, he felt empty and restless. When he was restless, he was dangerous. Time and experience had taught him that. If she wasn't at his side, Matthew would find it impossible not to stalk her until she was within arm's reach once more. And then Domenico's words might become prophetic, and Matthew would hurt her despite his feelings for her. That left war. War with his mother and Baldwin, with Maltz, and with friends like Hamish. Matthew didn't care about battling and killing creatures like Gébert and Domenico. If that was what it took to protect Diana, he would do it willingly. But going to war with his own family was a different matter. Caught between the witch he could not live without, and the family he loved, and to whom he owed so much, Matthew ached to hurt something, someone. He drew the badge of St. Lazarus out from underneath his sweater. The only person who deserved his rage was Domenico, and he was long gone. He couldn't go back inside and face his mother and Diana without a plan. Turning on his heel, he raced the stables in a blur. Inside, he rammed his feet into his boots and grabbed Balthazar's massive bridle before hoisting the horse's saddle and blanket onto his shoulder. Balthazar eyed him warily.
Don't try my patience today, my friend.
Matthew threw the reins over the horse's head and snared him. He opened the stall door, and Balthazar stamped in indignation at the rough treatment. Matthew got the bit into his horse's mouth and flung the blanket and saddle over his back. Balthazar was unacquainted with war, but he knew instinctively that his master meant business. Uncharacteristically, the horse stood still while Matthew tightened the saddle leathers. When the vampire lifted himself into the saddle, Balthazar didn't protest, but flicked his ears back and forth, waiting to be told what to do next. Matthew kicked him gently, setting off down the center aisle of the stables with a clatter that drew the attention of Dar and Rakasa, who had hoped to be going out again today. As horse and rider broke out of the stable and entered the paddock, Matthew bent over Balthazar's neck, the silver coffin of the pilgrim's badge swinging gently.
Run,
he growled. The enormous horse shot toward the paddock fence. Improbably, he lifted his bulk into the air and sailed across the bars. His hooves thundered against the ground as he galloped toward the forest at breakneck speed. Matthew let loose a roar of frustration when they were out of earshot of the castle, then settled into the saddle. He would stay astride Balthazar until he figured out what to do about the witch who awaited him back at Septour. Locations. Oxford. The city of Dreaming Spires lies at the heart of the All Souls world. This is where Diana discovered Ashmole 782. This is where she and Matthew met and fell in love. The city's clinging fog, fabulous architecture, and atmosphere of ancient learning and tradition can make the most resolutely ordinary human believe that there is magic just around the corner. Fairy tale settings combine with a modern market town, full of tourists, students, and residents going about their business on crowded city streets. There are all kinds of creatures living in Oxford, drawn to its cultural richness and learning. Demons and witches are more often found in the libraries, and vampires in the research labs. But when Diana first called Ashmole 782 up from the stacks, it brought all three species flocking to the Bodleian in unprecedented numbers, determined to understand the secrets of her discovery. Bodleian Library.
The leather-bound volume was nothing remarkable. To an ordinary historian, it would have looked no different from hundreds of other manuscripts in Oxford's Bodleian Library, ancient and worn.
Oxford's famous library is the key location in the story of Ashmole 782, inside and out. From the moment you pass the striking Radcliffe Camera Building and enter the gates into the quadrangle, seeing the spires above, the leaded windows and the statue of King James, you will find yourself in a bookish wonderland. The statue at eye level is Mary Sidney's son, William Herbert. Each of the ancient doors around the quad leads to specific medieval schools or departments. More than just a visual treat, the library is also a symbol of long-lost secrets, ancient knowledge, and modern scholarship. It's a place where old books and the latest computers exist side by side, much as magic and science do in this world. Entering the library on a typical day, you would see staff at work, readers and scholars poring over priceless books, and exhausted students resting their heads on their desks. Underneath all this activity, there is another library, magical, enchanted, a place where books appear and disappear according to the logic of old spells cast by witches intent on protecting precious information. Duke Humphreys.
I nodded to the busts of Thomas Bodley and King Charles I that flanked the arched entrance to Duke Humphreys and pushed through the swinging gate by the call desk.
Within the Bodleian Library, the beautiful Duke Humphreys is the reading room for Diana. With its ancient wooden desks, Gothic painted ceiling, and stained glass windows, it is a perfect place to find a witch, a vampire, and a lost manuscript. Here the creatures circle Diana following her discovery of Ashmole 782, and this is where she first felt the icy focus of Matthew's stare.
It had been no more than an hour since I'd been with Matthew, but the sight of him stretched out among the first bay of Elizabethan desks in one of the medieval wing's purgatorial chairs was welcome.
If you venture to the arts end of Duke Humphreys, you can see the busts of King Charles I and Sir Thomas Bodley flanking the arched entrance, watching over the readers as they did Diana the night she broke into the library to unite the Book of Life with its lost pages.
As a research student at Oxford, I spent a lot of time in libraries. College libraries like All Souls, Merton, and Corpus Christi, the History Faculty Library, as well as most of the different reading rooms at the Bodleian. When I wasn't in Duke Humphreys looking at rare books and manuscripts, my friends knew that they would find me in the Bodleian's upper reading room, surrounded by index cards and notes. The amazing architecture, the painted friezes along the walls, and the collection of portraits atop the bookcases provide plenty of inspiration for any historian or novelist.
Upper reading room.
I glanced through the small window stuck into the swinging door that led to the upper reading room, and I gasped. The room was full to bursting with creatures.
Bridge of Sighs.
The vampire sat in the shadows on the curved expanse of the bridge that spanned New College Lane.
Also known as Hartford Bridge, this raised walkway joins two parts of Hartford College over New College Lane and is a much-loved and iconic Oxford landmark. From here, Matthew could watch unnoticed as Diana walked below him, heading back to her college. New College Lane.
No matter what I told myself in the quadrangle, my walk home was faster than usual. The gloom of New College Lane was a spooky proposition at the best of times.
New College.
Fleeing from the warden's lodgings, I turned toward my old refuge in the cloisters and walked among the pillars until my pulse stopped racing.
Diana Bishop's alma mater and her host institution during her research fellowship in England, New College is known for its well-preserved medieval garden, its Gothic cloisters, and the beauty of its buildings. Number 7 staircase off the garden quadrangle leads up to where Diana's rooms were. All Souls College.
A pair of ornate, scrolled gates guarded his college as if it were Wonderland.
Matthew Claremont's august institution is the quietest of the Oxford colleges, despite its busy location off the Radcliffe Quad, between Broad Street and the High. And it has frontage facing the Radcliffe Camera, as well as High Street. Unless you are a scholar with permission to enter through the Codrington Library, you will have to use the High Street entrance. Walking through to the final quadrangle reveals Hawksmoor's famous towers, reaching the sky. Covered Market.
I went shopping along the aisles of Oxford's Covered Market. List in hand, I made my first stop at the butcher for fresh venison and rabbit, and then to the fishmonger for Scottish salmon. Did vampires eat greens?
Oxford's bustling Covered Market was originally opened at the end of the 18th century to bring all the city's messy food stalls under one roof. It is still home to a range of traders, the majority of whom deal in delicious fresh food. It was the best place for Diana to find the quality produce she needed to cater to a vampire with a refined palate. Christ Church Meadow and the Isis River.
We walked in silence for a few minutes, wrapped up in the gray fog and the strangeness of being alone, witch and vampire.
Residents of Oxford will spend whole days walking through the meadow, wandering down to picnic on the banks of the Isis River, and watch the boats go by when the weather permits. Walking toward the river soon takes you to one of the main towpaths. Turning left on it takes you down past the university boathouses. Going right leads to the stone bridge used by cars. Carefully crossing over the bridge and using this towpath will give you a different vantage point and allow you to carry on down past the boathouses opposite. Diana rode this way, under Donington Bridge, past the City of Oxford's boathouse on the other bank, and to the Isis Farmhouse pub at a spot in the river known as Haystack's Corner.
I managed to get down the river, but the serenity of the outing had evaporated. Turning the boat in front of the Isis Tavern, I spotted Claremont standing beside one of the pub's tables. He'd managed to get there from the Donington Bridge, on foot, in less time than I'd done it in a racing skull.
Woodstock. The picturesque village of Woodstock, within easy distance of Oxford, is today known as the place where tourists have lunch before visiting nearby Blenheim Palace, as well as for its historical association with the craft of glove-making. In the world of All Souls, this is where Matthew's house, the Old Lodge, is located. The village is a wonderful example of a medieval town in the Oxfordshire countryside. Like Matthew, Diana is lucky enough to know it in both the Tudor and modern periods. Long ago, there was a royal palace in Woodstock, and the area was popular with members of the royal family who wanted to hunt and breathe some country air. Henry VIII was especially fond of the deer park there. Woodstock was less recreational for Elizabeth Tudor, who in 1554 was imprisoned in the palace by her sister Mary. The medieval palace is long gone, its stones and bricks used to build Blenheim. But Matthew's local church, St. Mary Magdalene, can still be seen. The spectacular timbered ceiling will make you think you have time-walked to 1590, and you may hear the same bells that Diana did, tolling the hours. The Old Lodge.
A two-story Tudor manor house was arranged around a central courtyard. Its bricks glowed in the illumination of powerful spotlights that shone up through the branches of gnarled oak trees to light the face of the building.
In 1536, during the early dissolutions of the monasteries, Henry VIII rewarded Matthew for his services to the crown by gifting him land that had been occupied by a religious house. Matthew was forced to tear down the monastery, and he built a house on the site of the ruins. As both a carpenter and a stonemason, Matthew chose not to use the stones of the old foundation for his house, believing that to do so would be sacrilege. Instead, he built a massive half-timbered Tudor mansion in the middle of the Cotswolds. Its black and white facade sticks out like a sore thumb amid the warm Cotswold stone of the area's architecture. But the de Clermonts have never been slaves to fashion. Diana was stunned by Matthew's beautiful Oxfordshire house when he first took her there for a yoga class. Looking at the real Tudor manor house that inspired the old lodge and grounds, it's easy to imagine her reaction. The striking Speke Hall is located in the north of England, near Liverpool, rather than in the Cotswolds, and dates back to 1530. Its exterior and design, as well as the interiors of the wood-paneled Great Hall and the ornately carved bed in the Tudor green bedroom, conjure the old lodge's atmosphere and presence. Speke Hall also has a priest hole, a common feature in that period of religious persecution, as well as a peephole in one of the bedroom's chimneys, allowing occupants to spy visitors coming up the approach to the house.
I was an impressionable 8 years old when I first visited Speke Hall. It has always been the Tudor house of my imagination, so I just had to have it for Matthew. In a move of authorial invention, I relocated it to Oxfordshire, even though the half-timbered architecture isn't really characteristic of that region. Speke Hall is now operated by the National Trust, and the house and grounds are open to visitors, so be sure to drop in if you're ever in the area.
Chipping Weston.
Chipping Weston was the type of picturesque English village where novelists like to set murder mysteries. It looked like a postcard or a film set, but it was home to several hundred people who lived in thatched houses spread out over a handful of narrow lanes.
When looking for a village to serve as a model for Chipping Weston, the home of demon Timothy Weston, I discovered Weston on the Green. It seemed meant to be. The medieval village has preserved many of its historical sites, including the public stocks where residents were punished for their crimes. The model for Timothy's house is a hotel, the Manor at Weston on the Green, dating back to the early 16th century, with various additions and renovations carried out over the years.
Scotland. Cadzow Lodge.
Little about this part of Scotland was soft or inviting, and its forbidding beauty suited his present mood. He downshifted through the lime alley that had once led to a palace and now led nowhere, an odd remnant of a grand life no one wanted to live anymore. Pulling up to what had once been the back entrance of an old hunting lodge, where rough brown stone stood in sharp contrast to the creamy stuccoed front, he climbed out of his Jaguar and lifted his bag from the trunk.
Hamish Osborne's Scottish hunting lodge, Cadzow, was inspired by Châtellerault Country Park in Hamilton, Scotland. Built in 1732 as a hunting lodge for the Dukes of Hamilton, Châtellerault was designed by the neoclassical architect Robert Adam, 1728-92, and is all that is left of a once vast estate. The remains of the tree-lined avenue that Matthew drove down once linked the hunting lodge to the famously grand and luxurious Hamilton Palace, seat of the Hamilton family, which was eventually demolished in 1921. The ruins of 16th-century Cadzow Castle can still be seen in the grounds of Châtellerault Country Park, overlooking the gorge of the River Avon. The nearby town of Hamilton was also once named Cadzow, but the name was changed in the mid-15th century in honor of the first Lord Hamilton. Matthew isn't a fan of Hamish's gaudy, ill-conceived folly, with its grand and drafty dining room. But to Hamish, the lodge's lavish design and impracticality are the perfect sign of how far he has risen from his Glaswegian roots. Matthew and Hamish have spent many contented evenings here drinking wine and whiskey and playing chess. Shadow of Night outtake. The voyage to France. Five of us set out from the old lodge in Saturday's pre-dawn darkness. Our early departure was timed to take full advantage of the meager 7 hours of daylight between sunrise and sunset. Riding a large black stallion named Brutus, Matthew issued final orders to the staff, while Walter, Galloglass, and Pierre completed their own preparations for the journey. My chestnut mare had been tacked up with a side saddle for propriety's sake. I sat on it gingerly and hoped for the best. Isabeau had dared me to ride side-saddled Septour, and I thanked Matthew's mother silently for doing so while my horse fidgeted impatiently in the courtyard. I managed to stay on her back, despite the slip of my woolen skirts against the leather and velvet saddle, all the while thinking longingly of my modern black riding breeches and boots. Once clear from the boundary of Matthew's estate, we took the muddy track that would one day become the smoothly paved, considerably wider Woodstock Road, and turned toward the south coast of England. En route, we passed lumbering wagons, as well as people traveling on smaller, tired animals. Matthew spared no expense in acquiring fresh horses from the inns stationed conveniently along the way. For Elizabethan spies, the key to speed was a ready supply of good horse flesh, rather than a fast car. For the first part of the journey, I was delighted to be outdoors and seeing more of 16th-century England. The countryside looked as I had expected it would, small clusters of houses and barns cobbled together from a combination of stone, plaster, wood, and thatch. Gray plumes of smoke rising from chimneys and autumn bonfires, animals set out to pasture, and people going about their daily tasks. But I reveled in the small details of life that history books seldom mentioned. The flurry of birds entering and exiting dovecotes, the cries of children as they gleaned the walnuts that had been shaken from the trees in Thursday's storms, their hands stained from contact with the hulls. The dogs that roamed freely and kept the sheep, cows, and nut-collecting children safely corralled. The women who were taking advantage of today's break in the rain to do laundry. By noon we had traveled nearly 30 miles, but there were as many still before us. After climbing onto my third horse, I could muster no further interest in the passing sights and sounds. I was aware only of crushing fatigue, and the bizarre sensation that the earth was moving underneath me, even when I was standing still. When we changed horses yet again, Matthew insisted that I rest and have some food. Though nothing was said, it was clear that I was slowing us down. "Let me ride astride," I murmured to Matthew, working my gloves off chilled fingers. "We could go faster if I felt more secure on my horse."
"It's too risky," Matthew said, casting a look from the window of our private room to the inn's busy courtyard. "We've already drawn attention by traveling in such a large group. A woman riding astride would suggest there was an emergency that put speed over decorum."
I was about to point out that we were in precisely that situation when Raleigh intervened.
"There's little hope of making Portsmouth by nightfall," Walter observed quietly, handing me a beaker of wine and pointing me to a roasted capon that was steaming on the table.
As my stomach was churning with exhaustion and motion sickness, I lowered myself into a nearby chair instead, my hips and thighs protesting.
"Then we will change our plans," Matthew said curtly, his eyes still on the courtyard below.
Walter's prediction was realized at the outskirts of Winchester when I toppled from my horse. Had I not been traveling with three vampires, it would have been a nasty fall. Instead, Galloglass caught me, Pierre kept my horse from bolting, and Matthew carried me to our lodgings for the night. The last thing I remembered clearly was the blinking of lamps in the dusk, and the spires of the cathedral rising from the chalky soil of the downs. When my eyes opened, I was lying in a comfortable bed. I still felt the sensation of movement, rather like the one I had after a long row on the river, when, despite being on dry land, I could still feel the run of water under the boat's hull. Matthew waited beside me. Two men in somber black habits stood nearby, large crosses worked in silver thread over their hearts. Startled by the sight, I tried to get up.
"Everything's all right," Matthew said, carrying my hand to his lips and kissing the ring on my third finger.
"Where are we?" I asked after I'd fallen back onto the pillows.
"You're at the Hospital of the Holy Cross, Madame de Clermont."
A middle-aged man at the front of the huddle stepped forward. I was surprised that he knew Matthew's true identity, as well as our relationship. Clearly, I still didn't understand the rules of being a spy's wife.
I am Robert Bennett, the master of the hospital.
A hospital? How long have I been here? I grabbed for Matthew's hand. 16th-century hospitals were places for incurable complaints, and last resorts for poor souls who couldn't afford any other treatment.
Not yet 30 minutes,
Matthew replied, smoothing my hair with his free hand.
You collapsed.
I've never collapsed. My protest was less effective from a prone position, and I struggled to sit up again. Matthew's hands on my shoulders kept me from doing so.
You did a damned fine imitation of it then, Walter said sharply.
Bennett raised an admonishing finger.
My apologies, Robert.
It was evident after listening to the next 20 minutes of conversation that the Hospital of the Holy Cross was part almshouse, part home for indigent travelers, and entirely within the control of the Knights of Lazarus. I wondered why Walter's orders had been obeyed immediately, and the promise of a hot bath later to ease my sore muscles. The answer lay in the signet on Walter's little finger, bearing the outlines of Lazarus and his coffin.
So you're a knight too, I said weakly as Walter and Matthew helped me out of bed.
Yes,
said Walter tersely.
And you must outrank Hancock.
Walter had effectively silenced him at the old lodge. Raleigh pulled out a chair for me in lieu of a reply.
What about Galloglass?
I outrank everyone in this room, madam, with the exception of your husband, Raleigh cautioned. And that includes you. So be quiet and eat what Brother Barnabas has prepared for your supper.
Brother Barnabas, who waited patiently by the table with a bowl, smiled at me encouragingly.
You have no authority over me, I shot back.
Exactly what is your role in the de Clermont's family business, Walter? Over my head, Raleigh's angry blue eyes met Matthew's.
Is she always like this?
Usually, Matthew said dryly. It takes some getting used to, but I rather like it. You might, too, given time.
Walter snorted, but answered,
I command the Brotherhood in England.
So you're one of the Order's 8 provincial masters and report directly to Philippe, I said thoughtfully. I wondered for a moment if you were the 9th Knight. The 9th Knight was a mysterious figure in the Order, his identity kept secret from all except those at the very highest levels. Raleigh swore so vehemently that Brother Barnabas gasped.
That's more than enough talk of the Brotherhood for one evening,
Matthew said, drawing me toward the fire in an attempt to distract me with food.
Your wife won't be satisfied leaving it there. She will worry at this like a hound with a bone.
Raleigh crossed his arms over his chest and scowled.
Very well. If you must know, Henry Percy is the 9th Knight. His unwillingness to embrace the Protestant faith makes him vulnerable to allegations of treason here in England, and in Europe he is an easy target for every malcontent who would like to see Her Majesty lose her throne. Philippe offered him the position to shield him from those who would abuse his trusting nature.
Henry? A rebel? I was stunned.
He's a powerful man, Diana, for all his soft skin and boyish manners.
Walter held out a polished pewter spoon.
Eat.
My questions answered, for the moment, I did what Raleigh commanded. The heat of the fire and the warmth of Brother Barnabas's excellent soup soon had me drowsing at the table, my lullaby the soft conversation between Matthew and Walter. Next morning, Matthew bundled me into the saddle in front of him to make up for lost time. We covered the distance to the south coast at a breakneck pace. I was accustomed to Dover as the preferred departure point for the continent, given the relatively short distance between it and the French coast, and was surprised that we were taking a longer route. Going from Portsmouth to Guernsey and then on to France meant we avoided the English stronghold of Calais and the more traveled roads around Paris. This crossing would be treacherous given the tricky currents, winds, and tides, Matthew explained. But Walter and Galloglass could make the journey blindfolded. In Portsmouth, I studied the thick stone walls that had been built to protect the harbor from French attacks, and noticed the number of ships at anchor, bulky merchant vessels, small fishing craft, even a few imposing warships outfitted with guns. Raleigh and Galloglass disappeared for several hours, and returned having procured a boat for the crossing. Both looked at me blandly when I asked for further information, and Matthew's forbidding expression soon stopped my questions. Whatever vessel we were sailing in was stolen. One glimpse of the boat made me wish that the thieves had been more daring. The small vessel had only two sails, a rough deck made from salvaged materials, including a garden gate and a battered door, and a distinct smell of fish about it. A few oars rested by the gunwales.
"It's not likely to sink, not before we reach Guernsey in any case," Walter said, flipping over a coil of rope with his toe.
A crab scuttled down the deck in alarm, and I was tempted to do likewise. Instead, I put one foot on the rickety surface. "If you need a break from rowing, I can lend a hand," I told Galloglass, as he helped me into the boat. Pierre chuckled and said something unintelligible in French.
"I'll be sure to let you know, Auntie,"
Galloglass said in a measured tone, though his eyes crinkled in amusement. He glanced at his uncle.
"So the witch has been around boats? You never cease to surprise me."
My husband gave him a withering look and hopped in after me.
"Galloglass grew up with an oar in his hand," Walter said with a grin. "As he's aware, he could probably row us to Virginia and back. We will have no trouble reaching Guernsey."
On board, Raleigh gave me a choice of seats, in the stern with him or down in the hold. The first was exposed to the elements, and the fresh breeze was rapidly becoming a cold wind. The second was close and sour-smelling. Though I had never been seasick, I elected to play it safe and sit where my eyes could remain on the horizon. Matthew bundled me up not only in my cloak, but also in his own, Galloglass's and Pierre's. The vampires, after all, didn't need them. Once the sun set, however, not even four cloaks could keep the cold at bay. Raleigh, cheeks bright red with excitement and the wind, seemed as oblivious to the temperature as the rest of them. But I was not so fortunate and crept below. There, the pitch of the boat was more obvious than it was on deck. Matthew unwound my cocoon and spread one cloak on the none-too-clean wooden table. He tightened the other two over my recumbent form so that I would be less likely to roll off in the swells, and returned to help steer us to shore. Raleigh's knowledge of the waters got us to the island off the French coast in less than 12 hours. He was assisted by Matthew's excellent night vision, a stiff southwesterly wind, and Galloglass, who kept up a running commentary about the poor construction of the ship. At last we disembarked and entered the village of Saint-Pierre. It was a frontier town, and its battered-down shutters and jumpy residents gave off an aura of ready violence. Soon the people of Guernsey discovered that it was Walter and Galloglass who had arrived, and the welcome became warmer. Pirates, smugglers, and outlaws of various nationalities appeared out of the murk to pass the time and share news. One escorted us to a nearby tavern that was still open for business, despite the hour.
"Look what the cat's dragged in. Where's your shadow, Galloglass?"
A petite woman with long black eyelashes and a complexion the color of churned cream stood in front of a cask of wine, hands on hips. She looked eagerly around his bulky shoulder and found me instead. My skin turned frosty under her gaze.
"Hello, Lizzie."
Galloglass bent over and smacked a kiss on each of her pale cheeks.
"Hancock's gone to Anglesey for Yule. I did think he expected to find his wife waiting to welcome him."
Lizzie sniffed.
"David drinks too much, and is with his family."
"Hancock will come here and fetch you, whether or not you want to go."
Galloglass sat down with a groan and beckoned at one of the servers.
"He is welcome to try," Lizzie said darkly.
She grabbed at the pitcher of wine and two tankards from a grizzled man with a rolling gait.
"These will do for the warm bloods, Brandon, but bring our best for the other gentlemen."
The female vampire fixed black eyes on Matthew.
"What are you up to then, young Matthew? Nothing good, I warrant."
Matthew looked frazzled.
"Galloglass assured me you would be in Wales."
My stomach dropped. Matthew kept saying there was no chance of running into his mother at Septour, but it seemed no one was where they were supposed to be.
"We've traveled down that road already."
Bird-like eyes looked at me with amusement and a touch of speculation.
"As your man seems unwilling, you might tell me what to call you."
Matthew stepped forward, and Lizzie put up an imperious hand.
"Do not interrupt, lordling."
Walter and Galloglass busy themselves with the fastenings on their cloaks. Matthew, unmoved by Lizzie's swagger, responded anyway.
This is my wife, Lizzie.
And her name?
Lizzie waited for a few moments, then gave an exasperated sigh. You cannot expect me to address her as Madame de Clermont, given the way I feel about your mother. Diana, I said quickly, and bobbed a curtsy.
Merciful Mary.
Lizzie gave a low whistle.
What I wouldn't give to see Isabeau's face when she discovers that her beloved Matthew has wed a witch.
When lasses whistle, Lizzie, the devil laughs outright,
Galloglass warned.
If it's proverbs you're after, you great Norse wolf, how about this one? A petite poche grosse bandit.
Lizzie's hands came to rest on her hips.
The smallest pig gets the biggest parsnip. Or at least he has thus far. I'm not sure what Isabeau will dish up for her pet when she hears this news.
I tensed at the mention of Isabeau.
My mother is in Germany,
Matthew murmured, resting his hand on my shoulder. This was no comfort. His mother was anything but predictable.
Aye, and I'm in Wales.
Lizzie's smile was mischievous.
If women did what men expected them to do, life would be very dull.
And there would be far less bloodshed and trouble. Has Brandon gone to Saint-Malo for my drink? Or are your cellars as disorganized as your household?
Galloglass's patience with pleasantries had evaporated.
There's nothing wrong with my cellars.
Lizzie poked a finger at Walter as he moved past, stripping himself of his weapons.
You're very quiet, Poppet. What say you about all this?
If it would make any difference, I'd say it's none of your affair, Lizzie.
Walter's dagger landed point down in the table.
Show Matthew and his new bride some of your famous hospitality. A room with a bed and a fire in it, if you please. We have business with Crooked Ned. Then you can placate Galloglass. You know how he is when he's hungry.
Lizzie grumbled, but she followed his orders. Matthew and I were shown to a room with a small bed and a crackling fire. The personal objects here and there, a carved shell on the mantel, a potted hellebore sitting on a windowsill, led me to believe this was Lizzie's own bedchamber. I slept most of the day, while Matthew and Raleigh talked to the aptly named Crooked Ned, awoke in the evening long enough to have some vegetable stew and cheese, and then slumbered until past midnight. Matthew roused me in the dark of Monday morning.
It's time, he whispered.
Walter left us at Guernsey, a lantern in one hand and the other lifted in farewell. There was a price on his head in Catholic Europe, and he could go no farther.
The penalty of being a hero,
he'd explained with his flashing grin and wicked eyes. The task of navigating the tricky waters now fell to Galloglass. We were in an even smaller boat for the next leg of our journey, but it was more seaworthy than the first. Silently he rowed us south through the inlets between the islands of Guernsey, Herm, and Sark, and out into the bay, where the tides whirled in all directions. Pierre sat in the bow with a shuttered lantern. Matthew stood by my side, one foot resting on the edge of the hull. I gripped the gunwale with one hand, Matthew's knee with the other.
What's our next port? The usual place?
Galloglass asked quietly as he put down his oars and raised the solitary sail. Though it would be more than 4 hours before the sun rose, other craft were visible in the darkness. I picked out the shadowed outlines of a sail, a lantern swinging from a post in the stern of a neighboring vessel. Walter said we were going to Saint-Malo, I said, my head turning in consternation. The port was full of men without allegiance to the French. Some had sailed under his command, and Walter had promised the rest could be made cooperative with a few coins.
I remember well enough where Raleigh told me to go, Auntie, but he's a pirate, and English, and he's not here. I'm asking Matthew.
France. Mont-Saint-Michel.
The boat was lifted up on the waves, and through the mist a steeple pierced the clouds. It was surprisingly close, the base of the structure obscured by the weather. We entered a room with a forest of columns holding up its vaulted roof. Large fireplaces studded the walls, spreading blessed warmth.
Diana and Matthew's first port of call in 16th century France, the famous Mont Saint-Michel, is a fortified monastery perched on islet just off the coast of Normandy. There has been a monastery there since the 8th century, founded by Bishop Aubert of Avranches. Surrounded by treacherous quicksands at low tide and the swirling waters of dangerous currents at high tide, Mont Saint-Michel has proved an impenetrable stronghold through the centuries, both in and out. For decades after the French Revolution, it was also used as a prison. Mont Saint-Michel was the original base for Louis XI's Order of St. Michael, the motto for which Matthew whispered as they approached it, with the Knights Hall dedicated to the order. City of Fougères.
After braving the exposed sands around Mont Saint-Michel at low tide and traveling inland, the Clermont allies welcomed us into the city of Fougères and lodged us in a comfortably appointed tower on the ramparts overlooking the French countryside.
Diana and Matthew stopped briefly at Fougères on their way to Septour. It is an ancient French town on the edge of Brittany, dating back to the end of the 10th century, and it can still be explored today. Château de Bougie.
This was René's favorite hunting lodge. It was so full of life when he lived here, with artists and scholars in every room.
The game that resided in the well-stocked forest surrounding Château de Bougie drew Matthew's old friend René, Count of Anjou, to build this grand hunting lodge in the mid-15th century. René was famed in his time as both an amateur painter and the author of several books, including King René's Tournament Book, describing the rules and customs of medieval tournaments. Village of Saint-Benoît-de-Sault.
We reached the stone walls and timbered houses of Saint-Benoît on schedule, just as Philippe had commanded.
Saint-Benoît-de-Sault, through which Matthew and Diana passed, is a beautiful French medieval village of winding cobbled streets overlooking the Portefeuille River, just northwest of the more dramatic landscape of the Auvergne. The landscape of the Auvergne is a microcosmic reflection of Matthew Clermont's appearance, history, and personality. It is at once forbidding and beautiful, with awe-inspiring peaks and shadowed valleys. Forgotten villages cling to the hillsides, their basalt fortresses and Romanesque churches a persistent reminder of how important this region once was to the history of medieval Europe. Now it is all goat herds, cheese-making, and ecotourism, but once this was the political and religious center of the Christian West. The First Crusade set off from this region, and even now you can climb the peaks and see the traceries of the Pilgrim Road from Paris to Compostela, snaking over the mountains. It is in the Auvergne that the ancient vampire elite settled when the Roman Empire crumbled and before the modern nation-states of Europe rose to power. The patriarch of the de Clermont clan, Philippe de Clermont, built his empire here in a village called Saint-Lucien, and the de Clermont have remained there ever since in their castle of Septour. The de Clermont also own other castles in the area, which is typical of the ancient vampire families who settled there during times of vampire warfare, when it was necessary to fortify their territory against possible invaders. In the case of the de Clermont, the rival power in the Auvergne is Gébert d'Aurillac, whose base is at the Château des Anges Déchus, Château of the Fallen Angels, in the nearby Cantal. Though an uneasy détente has been achieved between the d'Aurillac and the de Clermont vampire clans, their castles are a constant reminder of how vicious the contest for power once was. Château des Anges Déchus.
Arm in arm, Isabeau and Marthe walked out into the crisp dawn. The towers of Château des Anges Déchus grew smaller and smaller behind them until they disappeared from sight.
Gébert d'Aurillac's château is based on the Château de Ceylon in the Auvergne. Dating from the 13th century, this fortress was built on a triangular outcrop, with dungeons at each corner, and has changed hands frequently through the centuries. Château des Anges Déchus is the perfect base from which Gébert can plot and scheme, controlling his large network of vampires. It is also in close enough proximity to the de Clermont's for him to keep an eye on their movements. La Pierre.
We descended toward something that looked like a crater, set apart from the surrounding countryside by yawning ravines and overgrown forests. It proved to be the ruin of a medieval castle, with high walls and thick foundations that extended deep into the earth.
When Witch Satu Yarvanen yanked Diana out of the gardens at Septour, she took her to La Pierre and held her captive there. La Pierre is based on a medieval ruin in the Auvergne called Château de Meroul. A formidable fortress dating back from the 12th century, it survived many sieges during the French Wars of Religion, and was later abandoned as a residence following the French Revolution. Used briefly as a prison, and reportedly a thieves' lair, it eventually fell into ruin in the 19th century. Church at Saint-Lucien.
Like many religious buildings in this part of France, Saint-Lucien's house of worship was already ancient in 1590. Its simple lines were altogether different from the soaring heights and lacy stonework of a Gothic cathedral.
The village church of Saint-Lucien witnesses pivotal moments in Matthew and Diana's story over the centuries. It was in the half-built structure that Isabeau found Matthew's broken human body, and then gave him his rebirth as at De Clermont. Matthew and Diana were married at the door of the church in 1590, and finally in the 21st century, their twins, Rebecca and Philip, were baptized there. The inspiration for Saint-Lucien came from a Romanesque church built in the 16th century, as Saint-Lucien would have been, called Saint-Apollinaire, in Place Ravenna. The village church would have been far simpler than this one, with Matthew's hand evident in the carpentry, but the design and decorations would have been similar in style. Septour.
In the center of rolling hills was a flattened peak, dominated by a crenellated hulk of buff and rose stone. Seven smaller towers surrounded it, and a turreted gatehouse stood guard in front. This was not a pretty fairy tale castle made for moonlit balls. Septour was a fortress.
Philippe established Septour, Seven Towers, the family seat of the De Clermont, when the Roman Empire fell apart. It is the center from which the family's power maneuverings throughout the world are carried out, as well as the base for the Knights of Lazarus. This isn't a cozy family home, but a working household of ancient beauty and formidable strength. Septour was modeled after Château Dauphin and Pontgibou, right down to the decorations in the great hall, salon, and breakfast room. This 12th century castle is the latest in a series of residences built on the site that date back to AD 400. Like the other castles in the Auvergne, Dauphin has seen its share of warfare, changing hands through the Hundred Years' War between England and France, besieged during the French Wars of Religion, and captured by a Huguenot captain who reportedly locked the defenders in their own dungeons. Le Revenant.
Le Revenant was smaller than Septour, but not by much. There were only four towers, Matthew pointed out, one on each corner of the square keep. But the moat that surrounded it was large enough to qualify as a lake, and the splendid stable complex and beautiful interior courtyard rather took away from any claims that this was more modest than the official De Clermont residence.
Le Revenant, a place Philippe de Clermont originally built to house returning crusaders, is Diana and Matthew's haven near Limousin. There they were able to enjoy a brief period of private calm when the twins were first born, and it later became a gathering place for their new Bishop Clermont scion. A gift from Isabeau, Le Revenant is cozy by her standards, with doors that assured privacy in every room, and modern conveniences like an elevator. This de Clermont residence is based, inside and out, on the impressive Château de Montbrun, a renovated medieval castle on the edge of the Limousin region. It was originally built by a returning crusader in 1179, Amérique Bruny. Brun. With alterations dating back to the 15th century and restoration work undertaken during the 19th century. You can imagine Diana and Matthew studying within its wood-paneled library under atmospheric lighting.
Inside, however, there was an intimate feeling to the place, in spite of its large public rooms on the ground floor. Though the castle had been built in the 12th century, it had been thoroughly renovated and was now fully updated with modern conveniences such as bathrooms, electricity, and even heat in some of the rooms. Despite all that, I was just winding myself up to reject the gift and any idea that we would ever live